North Korea said this weekend that it's not interested in further talks on its nuclear weapons program until the United States discusses a non-aggression pact with the communist nation. President Bush, traveling in Thailand for a conference, rejected the request. This follows North Korea's strongest hint yet that it plans to test a nuclear weapon. In the year since North Korea admitted to conducting a secret nuclear program, tensions with the United States have rarely eased, even after six-nation talks in Beijing this past summer. But the West has learned more about North Korea's mysterious leader, Kim Jong-il. Journalist Peter Maas interviewed defectors from North Korea, as well as South Koreans, Russians, and Americans who have met with Kim, including Wendy Sherman, a deputy to former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Maas's article, The Last Emperor, appears in this weekend's New York Times Sunday Magazine, and Peter Maas joins us from our New York Bureau. Thanks for your time.
Good to be with you.
What do you think is the biggest myth about Kim Jong-il?
That he's crazy. He's not crazy. That's really clear. When you talk to people who have spent time with him, to defectors who worked with him, even to Americans who went to Pyongyang in 2000, they all come out saying, look, this guy is sharp. He's intelligent. He's very much aware of the issues, has a grasp on them. He doesn't, you know, kind of go off and act in bizarre ways when you're talking with him. In fact, he can be quite friendly and charming. He's got it together in terms of having a good mind, one that is very well equipped and trained to rule over this very backward yet militarily well-equipped regime.
So his political skills have been underestimated.
They've been deeply underestimated. I mean, until really the last 2 or 3 years, so little was known about Kim Jong-il, because really very few people had met with him, that all that was known of him were these stories that circulated about wild parties that he held when his father was still alive, talk that he was responsible really for little more than terrorism, and that he was no more capable of ruling North Korea than Hugh Hefner would be, and it wasn't expected that once his father died that he would hold on to power very long. Of course, he has, even under very difficult circumstances, including a famine that killed about 2 million people.
You write that dictators come in different strains like poison, and Kim Jong-il is different from, say, Saddam Hussein in that he is not personally violent. He has never been known to raise a hand or a weapon against another. He's very friendly. So if he doesn't rule with the threat of physical violence, what is he like?
Well, when he interacts with his subordinates there, it's a very, you know, traditional Confucian sort of relationship in which when he speaks, everybody else listens. There's no real direct confrontation or presentation in any aggressive way of views that oppose his. When he's with the foreign visitors, it's another story entirely. Then there are exchanges that goes on. He's friendly. He's, in fact, very kind. I mean, when Albright visited in 2000, they had these banquets, but because she was a woman and he wanted to treat her slightly differently, he didn't let aides kind of continue with pouring more alcohol into her glasses because he thought it was inappropriate for a woman to be forced to drink as much as a man would be.
Kim is charming, as you mentioned. But you also write that Kim lives in a different world but doesn't always realize it. What would be an example of that?
When, for example, Albright, with her delegation, went to Pyongyang, he took them to the biggest stadium in Pyongyang, which is a really large stadium with about 200,000 people, and had one of these mass games, and these are intricately choreographed with dancers and with card sections that flip cards at split-second intervals, somewhat like, you know, at college football games, but this is taken to the nth degree. The precision is amazing. It's almost like watching a movie as these people flip the cards. And one that was particularly shocking for the Americans who were there, and I talked to several members of the delegation, it showed a North Korean missile being launched and rising into the sky. And it's not just a static picture of it. It was actually the missile kind of moving up the side of the stadium and going up into the air. And he used it actually for an interesting political point, because he turned to Albright and said to her, you know, that was my first missile launch, but that can be the last. And he turned to Wendy Sherman, who was Albright's deputy on that trip, and said the same thing. And he very clearly kind of coordinated, you know, what they were seeing with the political message that he wanted it to convey to them. He wanted to, you know, scare them or impress upon them the fact that, hey, I've got these missiles. But on the other hand, he also wanted to convey, and did quite clearly, the fact that, look, if you give me what I want, a new relationship with the U.S. and lots of foreign aid, then I won't be launching any more missiles.
You give the impression that Kim Jong-il is smart. He's very astute, more rational than some accounts have suggested. Then there's the problem of his weapons program. He tends to use this more as a bargaining chip than a real defensive or offensive capability. I think you call it bluffing is an integral part of his nuclear poker game.
Yeah, but it's not just bluff. I mean, it is his only bargaining chip in the sense of it's the only thing that makes outside nations pay attention to what he's doing. And it's the only thing for which outside nations might be interested in providing him aid in return for stopping or reducing his nuclear weapons program. And of course, you know, North Korea being on the list of Axis of Evil, which now only has two members, it is one country that could be subject to preemptive attack. He knows that. And the one thing that perhaps keeps that attack at bay is the prospect of nuclear retaliation. So it's a bargaining chip, but it also is a very real and important way for which he keeps his perceived enemies at bay.
You spent time as a reporter in Korea, and you were not able to interview Kim Jong-il. No Western reporter has been able to interview him. So, I mean, how difficult is it to profile someone you've never met?
Well, you know, when my editors asked me to do this story, I thought, okay, I'll certainly do it, but boy, I don't think I'll be able to get that much. But actually, it was much easier and more intriguing for me than I expected, because in the last 2 or 3 years, he's kind of come out of the closet in terms of meeting foreigners. These people have had a lot of interchanges with Kim Jong-il, and so it's in some ways useful to rely on hardcore and very rich sources like that rather than, let's say, a brief, very superficial interview that, you know, you would have with him. I mean, I perhaps would focus on that in the story that I wrote, but the interview I'd get with him wouldn't necessarily be as revealing as what people who really know him well have to say about him.
Peter Maas is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. His article, The Last Emperor, appears in this weekend's issue of the magazine. He joined us from New York. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.